They might seem hopelessly out of date and hard to authenticate for our modern sensibilities, but religious relics today can show us what was once highly treasured in the Middle Ages. A relic might be a piece of bone in a small jewel-like box, or even the entire skeleton of a holy person stored in a glass coffin under the altar. In the U.S., Catholic churches in Louisville, Pittsburgh, and Chicago, and a convent at Maria Stein, Ohio, are known for the relics they have on display. Historian Peter Manceau investigated the role of relics in his book, Rag and Bone, A Journey Among the World's Holy Dead. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Rick. Thank you.
You know, you wrote in your book that, actually, St. Paul wrote, faith is trust in things unseen. You quoted St. Paul. That really relates to relics, doesn't it?
It does. Relics are fascinating to me because they are at once something very much seen. I mean, the point of them is to go and see them, in fact. But for people who believe in them, they are a key to open a door to the unseen, basically. They are small physical objects that, for believers, relate to a whole universe of belief. And for me, as someone who writes about religion and loves traveling, they are always on my itinerary whenever I'm traveling.
So you wrote in your book, relics are a place where the abstraction of faith meets the reality of the physical world.
Yes, I think it's easy to assume that when we talk about religion, we're only talking about the unseen. We're only talking about prayer or people's beliefs. But we wouldn't have anything to talk about with religion if it was not a very real phenomenon. Whatever the content of our beliefs are, religious artifacts exist and they are powerful objects and they need to be contended with, no matter what we believe about them in themselves.
Now, a Catholic knows how to approach a relic, I think, properly, and a lot of Protestants sort of don't get it. I'm a Protestant. Are you a Catholic?
I was raised as a Catholic, and interestingly, as an American Catholic, growing up far from where the vast majority of relics are, which is in Catholic Europe, I didn't grow up with too much awareness of them. We knew what relics were. We knew what they signified. We knew that they were important and holy and all the rest. But they were as foreign to us growing up, I think, as they were to many American Protestants.
Well, to a Protestant, it seems like you're worshiping something that's just a thing. But in actuality, wouldn't you say a relic is not to be worshipped, but it's an aid to help you worship?
Well, that's exactly right. And Catholics think about it. The official line about relics is that they are not too different from an icon or a crucifix or a statue of a saint, in that all of these things are not the gods themselves, not the saints themselves, but are only aids to the imagination, aids to the religious imagination. They are basically conduits for your prayers. If you direct your devotion toward them, they'll get your prayers where they need to go. They have a way of sanctifying in a very real and direct way the spaces in which they appear. For example, every Catholic church around the world has a relic, whether or not it's on display. It is hidden deep within the altar of the church, and it is the presence of that relic that truly makes the place holy and makes the altar someplace where the liturgy, where the Mass can take place in an effective way.
So that's almost like a legality, I guess. I was at a church in Volterra in Italy, and my guide took me to the church, and it was not a very well-known church, and he lifted up the cloth on every one of the altars in the chapels. There must have been six or eight chapels in that church. Lifted up the white cloth, and he showed me a little cut-out piece of marble, a little patch, and he said, under that patch is the relic that sort of legitimizes this altar. And I didn't realize that.
In most American cities, you see that a number of churches are no longer serving a religious purpose. Some of them in Washington, where I live now, have been turned into condominiums, for example. And in each of these churches, if they were Catholic churches to begin with, there has been a ceremony that has taken place when the church is no longer in service. There's a ceremony in which the relic is removed from the altar and desanctifies this church, basically.
Wow. So formally, physically decommissioned, and they yank the relic out. It's like taking the SIM card out of a cell phone. It's not going to work anymore.
It's exactly like that. Unlike a SIM card, though, you might just get rid of when you're done with it. These, of course, are treated with great respect, and they are taken to another place to hold them until they can be put into another altar in another church or just held permanently.
Fascinating. I'm speaking with Peter Manceau, who writes a book called Rag and Bone. Peter's website is petermanceau.com, PETERMANSEAU.com, and we're talking about relics. William's on the phone in Miami. William, thanks for your call.
Hey, Rick, how's it going?
Good. Got a thought on rags and bones for Peter here?
Well, yeah. My question is that since, you know, quite a few of these holy relics were purchased during the time of the Crusades and are probably, you know, kind of dubious authenticity, are the churches, like, in possession of them right now? Are they interested in checking the authenticity given the new technologies available now, or would they just rather not know after all this time?
You open up a whole range of questions, in fact. And first of all, I want to say that you mentioned the Crusades, and it's worth remembering that in some ways this was fought on behalf of relics. Many of the Crusaders who went to Jerusalem to take back the Holy Land really went because they wanted to line their pockets with these religious treasures and bring them back to Europe. So most of the artifacts that we see are in churches around Europe, that's where they came from, and that's how they ended up there. And you're right that they've been in possession of various churches for so long, many of their provenances are unknown. They've often been gotten by ill-gotten means, and only now, as science has developed to identify these things, is it really possible to ask a question about their authenticity and to really find an answer. In the book, I spent a lot of time with a paleopathologist in Paris, and he has made it his project to identify and to test through DNA and radiocarbon dating a lot of these religious artifacts. Most of his work has been on a piece of rib bone that for the past century has been believed to be the last remains of Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc was burned at the stake, and so it's not often thought that she had any remains at all, and yet this one relic has persisted. So he has made it his work to authenticate this relic or de-authenticate the relic. And the church, to its credit, has been fully on board with this. They want to know the truth about the objects that they revere.
Well, I was in Paris last week myself, and they had the Crown of Thorns on display. Has anybody checked that one?
Not as far as I know. And there's really not much that can be done with some of these relics to determine how old they are or, in the case of bodily remains, who they once belonged to, because when you're testing for DNA, you need another sample to test it against. But I also think that there is something significant about relics, regardless of whether or not they are authentic, regardless of whether or not they are, quote-unquote, the real thing. And that's just because for the past, in the case of something like the Crown of Thorns, for the past more than 1,000 years, here's an object that has been the object of veneration for untold millions of people. And that in itself makes it religiously significant. It makes it worth thinking about.
Yeah, they built St. John's Teleport, didn't they?
Actually, the king paid more for the thorns than he paid for the great church to contain it, the Sainte-Chapelle. I mean, so it was important 1,000 years ago or 800 years ago when they brought it to Paris. And I think that's a cool point that Peter makes, is that even if it is bogus from a non-religious point of view, 1,000 years of faith and focus actually gives it some sort of connection, and it takes on a value in itself, doesn't it? Is that what you're saying, Peter?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And I should say that I come to this book not as a believer, but not entirely as a skeptic either, because I'm not interested in debunking these things so much as I am in examining the stories that have surrounded them for 1,000 years. And more importantly to me as a journalist, I'm interested in the lives that currently revolve around them. I'm interested in the people who still make these things the object of their faith.
Well, I find it fascinating. When I go to the large churches, I always go in the side chapels and check for the reliquies and things like that. But one quick aside, Rick, I stopped by Chartres.
Yeah.
And I noticed you mentioned there about the Mary's birthing veil.
Right.
That it had been carbon dated. They didn't have it on display, though.
Right.
And plus, they had so much scaffolding up, it was not worth going to.
I think carbon dating is bad news for relics, William.
I think so, too.
Thanks for your call, William.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. You know, William brings up an interesting point, Peter, that if you got, let's say, the Vatican, which its legitimacy is resting upon the fact that it is built upon the tomb of St. Peter, and all of a sudden there's new technology that lets you take those bones under there and do some testing, they're not eager to challenge the legitimacy of the whole thing. I don't blame them for wanting to keep that in the dark. And like you, I don't think that's the point. I think that for 1,500, 1,800 years, people have been worshiping on that spot. Who really cares if it's the actual relic? Because people aren't worshiping that thing that is an aid for them to worship God.
That's exactly right. And I think that we need to give the church some credit in terms of being open to the use of science for understanding more about these objects that have been so long a part of the faith. In fact, there's a long history, well, not long in terms of the lifetime of relics, but at least for the past 100 years or so, of the church bringing in experts in tissue preservation, for example, as a way of preserving relics. And so they are not totally objectionable to science, especially when it can be used to benefit the relics that they venerate.
You know, you can relate that to 20th century history and think about the tomb of Lenin in Red Square or Elvis Presley's artifacts or all the people that want to see Gandhi's spinning wheel or other examples like this. It even kind of lets us understand maybe the impact of relics in the old days to see how people do this pop kind of culture stuff today.
That's right. And, you know, I really believe that relics predate religion and will survive religion. And it's not only a religious instinct, just as it's not only a Christian instinct. You find relics in every religious tradition nearly, and you find them outside of religious tradition as well. And the fascinating thing about it in terms of travel is that wherever they exist, they become the site of pilgrimages. People come to see them by the thousands.
Oh, I've waited in line hours to see Lenin's body. Nothing religious about that. And, well, I guess communism was a religion and he was the prophet. Will all religion have some interest in relics? Do some religions have more than others?
Well, each religion has a slightly different understanding of the body in death.
And you talk about what a big deal Buddha's tooth is down in Sri Lanka, right?
Buddha's tooth is a popular relic in a few different places. I visited the one in Sri Lanka. There's also a popular relic of Buddha's tooth in China and also in Myanmar. The tooth in Kandy in Sri Lanka that I visited is really the center of Sri Lankan society. It is the focal point of what it means to be Sri Lankan is the tooth of the Buddha.
Wow. Historian and novelist Peter Mansoho is a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, and he founded its Center for the Understanding of Religion in American History. We talked with him on Travel with Rick Steves when he had just released his book, Rag and Bone, A Journey Among the World's Holy Dead. Since then, Peter's written the Jefferson Bible, a biography, the history of the last Yiddish poet in Baltimore called Songs for the Butcher's Daughter, and his book, Vows, which tells the story of his parents, a former Catholic priest and nun, whose marriage caused quite a stir in Boston in 1969. Peter's website is petermansoho.com, spelled M-A-N-S-E-A-U. We've got Katie on the phone from Victoria, British Columbia. Katie, thanks for your call.
Hi. Well, I have a question about approaching relics or viewing them in churches. Is there any protocol or custom that you have to observe or that you should observe when approaching these relics?
I think that your best bet is to follow local custom as best you can. And so if you are in a Catholic church in Italy, let's say, you may want to cover your head if the women around you, if the locals are covering their heads. I spent a lot of time looking at relics in Turkey, and when you go to a mosque in Turkey, you most certainly don't want to be wearing shorts, for example. And so you just want to follow the lead of the locals as best you can. And if you do that, I think that you will find that your interest in the relics is welcome, and the locals will want to talk to you about them and tell you why they are important to them. But always follow the lead of the locals, I think, is the creed of relics.
And Katie, it's easy to do because if it's a big-time relic, there's usually a bit of a line to get to the front to look into that murky glass case and see the vocal cords of St. Anthony and Padua, right? And you got a chance to look at everybody ahead of you and see what they're doing. And it just makes sense, as Peter says, to assume the same respectful manner that all of the pilgrims there are assuming as you pass in front of that relic.
Great.
I've also found, Katie, and they're a wonderful opportunity to talk to people in a way that you might not be able to just walking out around a new city. The people who are there who make a habit of coming to see the relics for reasons of religious belief, they want to tell you about them. I think they are flattered by your curiosity that you have come so far to be a part of their life in this way. It can be a great way to go past just asking directions in a new place and really start to make friends.
Peter Mansoho is a curator at the National Museum of American History in Washington. He explores the role of religious relics in his book, Rag and Bone. He's also written a novel set in 14th century Europe at the time of the plague. It's called The Maiden of All Our Desires. We have links to his work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Nicole's on the line in Dallas. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for your call.
Yes, I'm Catholic, and I've seen a lot of reliquaries in Europe, but one of the most spiritual experiences I had was actually at a mosque in Istanbul. We took the ferry up the Golden Horn to Eyüp and went to the Eyüp Sultan Mosque where Eyüp Ansari is buried. And it's supposed to be the fourth holiest place in Islam after Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. And so there were all these Muslims there that had come from probably all over the place, praying at the tomb, and the whole complex is just really peaceful, and it was really a beautiful experience.
Boy, I would highly second that thought so people can understand. It's E-Y-U-P, Eyüp. It's, for me, far and away the most powerful people watching, spiritual, Muslim pilgrimage kind of experience a tourist can have in Istanbul, because that, as you mentioned, is a pilgrimage destination, whereas the Blue Mosque and Hagia Sophia are cruise ship destinations more so.
Exactly. There were not as many people, and there was definitely an air of prayer and calm as opposed to gawking. And people were visiting outside the area. I mean, it was just a real feeling of community.
Conviviality, and also a conservative sort of Muslim fundamentalism. And that gets you tuned into a very interesting dynamic in the secular country of Turkey, that there's a lot of push for more and more connection of mosque and state instead of separation of mosque and state. Nicole, thanks for your insight. That's a great tip.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
What struck me when I was there was the number of families outside, and all of the little boys were dressed in these great flowing silver capes with crowns on for some particular ceremony that they were engaged in. And it was a great reminder to me that it's so easy from afar to think of mosques as places where only religion happens, but they are hubs of the community as well. And often the relics are the focal point, and so the families will crowd in and be near to the relic, and then they'll go outside and they'll get themselves an ice cream cone and be just like families here, out enjoying the day.
I remember the families at Eyüp in Istanbul and the cute teenage girls with their high heels and their trendy clothes underneath their religious garb. And you could see the real dynamic of their faith and their struggles and their growing up and their multi-generational approach to things in the modern world, meeting the traditional world, all around a church which had a relic that brings a lot of pilgrims together.
And Turkey is such a fascinating place for religious travel lately because while there are all of these Muslim sites and the Muslim faithful as well as tourists go to see them, there's also a whole range of Christian sites that have become a focus of growing Christian tourism from North America mostly. And there's a nice intersection of these two communities. They often bump into each other at sites, and seeing the coming together of two groups of people traveling for reasons of faith is really eye-opening.
You know, that's a very good point, Peter, because a lot of tourists want to see the House of the Virgin Mary in Ephesus, and it's also a Muslim holy spot because Mary and Jesus and John the Baptist and lots of biblical characters are also venerated in the Muslim faith.
What I love about traveling, especially as a writer who writes about religion, is the opportunity to discover these commonalities that we might not know we have until we're on the spot and meeting people and asking them why they are there.
Peter, it's just been fascinating talking to you. You've seen a lot of relics in your work. Finish off with just a thought of the most powerful personal experience you had in your research on relics.
I was up in Kashmir in northern India, and as I went there, I was aware of it as a dangerous place. There's a lot of sectarian violence that happens there. And I went to see a contested relic. There is a hair of the Prophet Muhammad that certain Hindu nationalist groups have started to claim as their own, saying it's not, in fact, a Muslim relic, but a Hindu relic. I spent some time with a family that for eight generations has been the guardian of the relic. And what was most touching to me was meeting this old gentleman who grew up as the watchkeeper, the safekeeper of the relic. When he heard what types of traveling I was doing, he wanted desperately to know about other relics around the world. He wanted to know about Christian relics and Buddhist relics because it gave him some indication that his life had so much in common with those around the world whom he would never meet, but they did have this one article of faith in common.
I love it. Relics can help us connect with God, and at the same time, they help people connect with other cultures and other people. Peter Manzo, author of Rag and Bone, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Our website is managed by Andrew Wakeling. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio.